Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to form our habits, and how much influence do they have over our behavior? While we tend to recognize certain habits, waking up at a certain time every morning, walking the dog, brushing our teeth, it turns out a lot more of our daily activity is habit-driven than we may realize, and there are cues all throughout our day that remind us to do certain things without ever having to give them a second thought. My guest today wanted to understand the brain processes behind habit formation and how our tendency toward automatic behavior gives clever marketers a perfect opportunity to make their products part of our daily lives. Charles Duhigg is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. His new book is called The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Charles, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So half of what we do every day is just habit?
Just about. Yeah, there was a study done by Duke University a couple of years ago that looked at how many daily behaviors are, in fact, habits versus actual decisions that someone is making. And they found that about 45% of what we do essentially unthinkingly. It's just a habit that unfolds in our lives.
And you started thinking about the impact of habits in our lives in a sort of unlikely setting. You were reporting on the conflict in Iraq.
That's exactly right. About 8 years ago, I was a reporter in Iraq, and I had heard about an experiment that was going on about an hour south of Baghdad in a town named Kufa, where an army major was trying to stop riots from happening. And the major had gone into the town and talked to the mayor, and he had asked the mayor to remove the food vendors from the plazas. And so the mayor said, sure, no problem, I'll go and remove the food vendors. And a couple of weeks later, a crowd started growing around one of the mosques there and got bigger and bigger, and the local police radioed the base and asked them to stand by. And then as dusk came on, at about 5:30, the spectators in the crowd started getting hungry and started looking around for the kebab sellers that were usually there. But they, of course, had been told not to be there. And so those people went home. And then people at the fringe of the crowd who saw those people going home, they decided to go home themselves. And the crowd over about 45 minutes just totally thinned out, and the riot never happened. And in fact, in the 9 months that the army major had been there, there had not been one riot.
And it's because people were in the habit of getting a snack at that particular time, and then they would stick around, and then things would get ugly.
That's exactly right. I asked the major, how did you know that this would work, that this would stop the riots? And what he said was, crowds are essentially just people made up of habits, right? The habit of having dinner and getting hungry, that's one habit that pulls us away. The habit of when other people start throwing things and yelling, getting drawn into the drama, that's another habit. He said that the U.S. military is actually, when you think about it, one of the greatest habit experiments on Earth. And that by learning how habits work, you know, in the military you learn habits for loading your weapon under fire and thinking clearly without any sleep and even just getting along with people you can't stand or talking to your wife when you're on another continent or husband. He said that once you start thinking about things in terms of habits, it's like someone has shined a flashlight on the world and all of a sudden you see these new ways to influence change.
And it's really brilliant because when you have a lot of good habits in place, then the need to rely always on self-discipline is lessened.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. One of the things we know about self-discipline or willpower of any kind is that it's like a muscle, right? The more you use it in a day, the more tired it becomes. That's why it's pretty easy in the morning to have a grapefruit instead of something, you know, sweet. But by the time you get home from work and you're exhausted and the kids are, you know, screaming and there's a cookie on the counter or a beer in the fridge and you think to yourself, okay, let's just have that, is because you've exhausted your willpower muscle. But the nice thing about habits is that habits, in many ways, neurologically, are the opposite of willpower. Habits are something that unfold almost automatically, that we don't have to exert almost any effort to sort of allow to happen. And so if you can make certain behaviors into a habit, it doesn't tax that willpower muscle at all. In fact, it feels easy.
So from a neurological standpoint, a habit is the product of this three-step feedback loop. You get your cue, your routine, and your reward. Can you give us an example of how they work?
Sure, absolutely. And this is what we've learned in about the last 10 or 15 years. And understanding the neurology of that habit loop, that three-step process, has completely transformed how neurologists and psychologists think about habits. So a great example of this is, for instance, a bad cookie habit that I used to have. So every afternoon when I was writing this book, I would like get up in the afternoon. I work at the New York Times, and I'd go up to the 14th floor, and I'd have a cookie in the cafeteria and talk to some of my colleagues. So when I was talking to psychologists, I was asking them all these important questions, and then I would always end the conversation with, so can you tell me how to get rid of my cookie habit? And what they said was, you have to diagnose the cue and the reward here. Mm-hmm. So for the cue, we know from experiments that almost all cues fall into one of five categories. They're usually a time of day, a certain place, a certain emotion, the presence of certain people, or kind of a preceding ritual. So whenever I felt this cookie urge in the afternoon, I'd write down all those five things, like where I was sitting, what time of day it was, and I figured out pretty quickly the urge always hit between about 3:15 and 3:45 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. My cue was a time of day. And when I would feel that urge that, you know, probably my blood sugar would get low at that time of day, or just for whatever reason, that cue would trigger an urge to go up, a routine, to go up to the cafeteria and get a cookie. And then the reward, I thought, was the cookie itself. That it's a chocolate chip cookie. It tastes really good. But so I started doing some experiments because the researchers told me that the reward was probably more complicated than just a cookie. Hmm. So I started doing these little tests. One day, whenever I felt the urge, instead of getting a cookie, I got a apple because I figured if I was just hungry, then an apple would work.
Right.
And then the next day, I got a cup of coffee. Because I figured maybe it's my blood sugar is low, and I'm looking to the cookie to give me kind of a burst of energy. And then the next day, I thought maybe it was sweetness. So I took some Splenda, and I just dabbed Splenda on my tongue. And then the next day, I thought maybe the reward is just I need a break from my computer. So instead of going to the cafeteria, I just walked around the block. Mm-hmm. And what I figured out pretty quickly was the reward that I was really craving was socialization. Hmm. It was that whenever I went up to the cafeteria, I would talk and gossip with my colleagues for 10 or 15 minutes. And the cookie was kind of a convenient excuse for that. But if I changed my routine so that at 3:30 I got up and I would go to a colleague's desk and gossip for 15 minutes at his desk rather than up in the cafeteria, the urge for the cookie had completely disappeared.
Huh, so you could go back without having had the cookie but having had a little fat-free gossip and you were better.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. But the only way I would have known how to change that habit, how to change the behavior, was by focusing on and diagnosing the cue and the reward. The cue and the reward are these really powerful parts of a habit because they become intertwined neurologically to create a sense of craving.
Yeah.
And it's that craving that really propels us into almost automatic action.
What's so interesting about that, Charles, is that with a cookie, and I think, you know, for people who smoke, with a cigarette, after a while, the reward of the thing itself tends to diminish because we've become, pardon the expression, habituated.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Or at least the pleasure of the reward
tends
to diminish. What's interesting is, from a neurological perspective, rewards are very tricky. Mm-hmm. To take backing your car out of the driveway. So for most people, backing your car out of the driveway becomes a habit pretty quickly, right? You don't have to pay that close attention to sort of all the steps you're going through.
Right.
But researchers began to wonder, so what's the reward there? And so they did these experiments where they would basically do fMRIs, so watch people's the blood flow inside people's brains as they back their car out of the driveway or imagine themselves doing so. And what they realized is that when you successfully back your car out of the driveway, at the end of that routine, you have a momentary sense of relief. Hmm. There is actually this reward. It happens so quickly, and it's so unnoticeable that you don't really pay attention to it, but your neurology does. Your neurology notices that reward the same way that, for instance, if you get accustomed to eating a cookie or if you get accustomed to kind of that runner's high you get after running, after a while, it doesn't feel as pleasurable as it once did, but that reward is still there inside your neurology, strengthening that pattern and strengthening the neural synapses associated with it.
Which is a great thing if it happens to be a good habit and not such a great thing if it's a habit we could live without.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was to explain to people how this works so that they can begin deciding which habits they want and which ones they want to change.
So do we tend to have more positive or at least neutral habits than we have negative ones? We focus on the negative ones.
I don't know. I don't think there's been a study that kind of says like how many neutral versus good versus negative. Mm-hmm. I think you're exactly right that what we do know is that the bad habits tend to weigh on us.
Yeah.
A lot,
yeah.
Right? I mean, in some respects, really good habits, like going for a run, you can feel good about that.
Mm-hmm.
And people do feel good about that. But think of all the other good habits that no one ever compliments themselves for, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, getting dressed and getting out of the house.
After age four, right.
Right, right. Remembering how to get to work. You know, getting your emails done without it being a major ordeal. There's all these things that have become habits that we don't think of as good habits or bad habits, but they're actually great habits
mm-hmm.
because one of the reasons why our species has succeeded is because of this ability to take patterns and turn them into habits. If we had to think and make decisions about everything, it would be mentally overtaxing.
Well, we'd be paralyzed.
What's that?
We'd be paralyzed, basically.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. We'd be paralyzed. And in fact, people who have had injuries to a part of their brain known as the basal ganglia, which is where habits essentially form, those people, they are paralyzed because they have to decide everything. They have to decide whether to put their left foot first or their right foot first. Hmm. When you ask them what they want for lunch, it can take 20 or 30 minutes for them to decide. Habits are really, really important. And one of the messages of this book is, any habit can be changed. Once you identify and sort of diagnose the cues and the rewards around any pattern, you can take those things that bother you and you can make them into something that you feel better about.
And this is what I found fascinating, Charles. It can be changed, not necessarily eliminated. So what people have learned is that you have more success switching out a bad habit and putting a better one in its place than trying to have sort of no habit at that space in your life.
That's exactly right. And the reason why is because oftentimes when a habit forms neurologically, you're literally creating a neurological channel, right? You're making a strengthened connection in your brain. And so you can't just kind of willingly disconnect parts of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Once those areas are connected, they're there for good. But you can switch them. You can influence them to lead to a new behavior.
And I guess this also sort of explains why if you drive to work the same way every day and then one day you have to go a different direction to pick up your dry cleaning, at least for me, I'm more than likely to forget that.
Exactly, right. I mean, what's really interesting is they did these studies where they looked at the brains of rats while they learned a habit.
Mm-hmm.
And they put the rats in these T-shaped mazes. And the first time the rat would run through the maze, there was some chocolate at the end of it. It almost looked like the rat was being lazy. Like it would sort of meander. It would like sniff and scratch on the walls.
Mm-hmm.
But they had probes inside the rat's brains, and the probes showed that those rats' brains were working hard the entire time. They were chugging away, trying to analyze what you know when they would scratch on the wall, the scratching center would light up. When they sniffed, the sniffing center would light up.
Hmm.
But over time, as running through that maze became a habit, what happened is the rat would move faster and faster and faster towards the chocolate. And more interestingly, the rat's brain would start working less and less and less. In fact, it got to a point where the rat's brain was almost hardly working. It was almost as if the rat's brain had gone to sleep. And that's exactly why when you have to stop to pick up your dry cleaning on your way to work, you often forget it. It's because when you're in the middle of a habit, your brain, for all intents and purposes, has gone to sleep.
Hmm.
Or it's reallocated that mental capacity to think about, you know, what you want to say at the upcoming meeting or to daydream.
Hmm. Charles Duhigg is my guest. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're opening the lines now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Charles Duhigg is my guest. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. One really phenomenal example, Charles, of replacing the cue, the routine, and the reward with something different is the Alcoholics Anonymous model. Tell us about that.
Well, the one of the big questions for Alcoholics Anonymous is, why does it seem to work? AA was developed by... decades and decades ago, by people who had no background whatsoever in psychology, mm-hmm. almost no medical training whatsoever, scientific training. And in fact, the 12 steps that we've all kind of come to learn and that every addiction program has adopted, those 12 steps were, the reason why there's 12 of them is because there's 12 apostles in the Bible. And they were written one night by someone who was sitting on his bed, who was late for dinner, and he wrote them all out in about half an hour. And so the question becomes, why a program that doesn't seem to have any basis in science, why has it helped so many people? So in the last 15 years or so, researchers have finally started looking at AA, trying to figure out what makes it work. And what they've discovered is that much of AA is successful because it doesn't address a lot of the underlying causes for alcoholism. Rather, it addresses the habits around alcohol use. So many people who have problems with alcohol have essentially habit dysfunctions, right? They've gotten into the habit of, if you have a tough day at work, you come home, you go to the bar, you have a couple of drinks with friends, you sort of unload your problems. You have this emotional catharsis. And that's the reward, is a sense of relief after finally getting things off your chest that happens in the context of alcohol. What AA says is, look, we want to keep the same habit but change the routine just a little bit. So now if you come home from work, you've had a hard day, you want to get some stuff off your chest, instead of going to a bar, go to a meeting. Mm-hmm. And at that meeting, we're going to give you the same experience. You're going to talk to friends. You're going to have an emotional catharsis. You'll feel a sense of relief afterwards. Hmm. It's just a new routine, a new habit. And yet for millions of people, that proves effective at helping them keep sober.
And for many people, having a different group of friends sort of takes away that cue or some of the cues they would have to have started drinking.
That's exactly right. We know that one of the big cues for most habits is the presence of certain people. And so when you're around those people, I mean, I'm sure that everyone listening has felt the same thing. You start hanging out with your friends from college, and all of a sudden you start acting like you're in college again. Right? All those old behavioral habits that have been extinguished are suddenly reawakened once you're around those same people. Hmm. And so AA gives us a chance to find a new group of people. What's really important about this, though, is to keep in mind that, for most people, they can't totally uproot their life. They end up spending most of their time around the same people that they did when they were drinking because they're married and they have kids and they have friends and you can't move to a new town. And so one of the other things that AA does is it just helps people recognize those cues. Hmm. And we know from a number of studies that simply causing people to be aware of how the habit loop works makes it less powerful. And so oftentimes when you can say to someone, you want to drink when you're around Jim, keep that in mind. It makes it easier not to drink the next time they're around Jim.
Because you go into that meeting with Jim or that cup of coffee with Jim kind of armed with that knowledge.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a really interesting study that was done on looking at exercise habits. And they basically took a whole bunch of people who were in an insurance plan. And they all of them got classes on the importance of exercise. Half of them got an extra class where they just explained to them the habit loop, the cue, routine, and reward, and the science of how habits work. It only took about half an hour, this extra class. And then they were asked to write down some cues and some rewards to help them exercise. That group, 4 weeks later, the group that got that extra class was twice as likely to exercise 4 weeks later. Just being informed about the science and the structure of habits makes them easier to control.
Now, exercise is one of those habits, Charles, that a lot of people would like to work into their lives or work in a more fundamental way. I'm curious about what people can do. I have a sister who has run marathons, and she said when she didn't feel like running in the morning, she would just put her running shoes on and tell herself that's all she had to do. And sure enough, that almost always made her want to go out the door afterward.
Right, right. It's amazing how powerful that is, to kind of just give yourself a little bit of the cue that gets you going on down the chain of the habit. That's exactly right. So I think for your sister-in-law, probably her habit was cued by putting on those shoes. And once she put on the shoes, it just sort of felt more automatic. But by focusing on the cue rather than the routine itself, it makes it a lot easier to start the behavior, because you're not thinking to yourself, I'm about to go running. You're just thinking to yourself, I'm putting on some sneakers. And then the running sort of almost happens automatically afterwards.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phones now to Matt in Arlington. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I can already tell my phone's breaking up a little bit, but I wanted to ask what, if any, the difference is between patterns and habits. I know a lot of times, my wife and I, we were going through marriage counseling for a while, and we found that we had these patterns we weren't even aware of. Something would cue me and I would end up kind of following the same pattern every time we got into an argument. And I was wondering if there's any, if these fall along the same lines or if they're completely different things, and I will take my response off the air.
Interesting question. Thanks for your call.
So I think what you're talking about there is a habit, right? So very often when we talk about patterns, behavioral patterns, what we're talking about are habits, kind of these repeated behaviors. And to your point, communication habits are some of the trickiest ones to deal with, because they seem to be tied up so closely in emotional habits as well. One of the things we know from research experiments is that a lot of our emotional reactions are habitual. And they're habitual in a way that they unfold within microseconds. That's why sometimes the sense of defensiveness when someone emotionally attacks us, or when we feel slighted, or the sort of momentary sense of pleasure we might get from, seeing someone we don't like have a piece of misfortune. Those are emotional habits that we'd like to stamp out, but that for microseconds sort of erupt as soon as something happens. And when it comes to communicating with spouses or communicating with anyone else, these habits play an enormously important role in how we almost thoughtlessly react to what someone has said. Now, in some respects, this is not a bad thing, right? Because if our goal is to be truthful with them, what often happens is someone says something, and while we're thinking about how we want to respond, we respond habitually. And that gives them a fairly honest insight into our response. But the problem is that when that response is hurtful, or when that response is born out of sort of a habit of insecurity, then it can really mess up communication, because what you probably don't want to say to your wife is, I hate you for criticizing me. What you probably want to say is something thoughtful. But it's hard when that criticism first comes out to not respond habitually.
So talk about this. I know that you're a parent. So many of us as parents want to instill good habits in our children. And sometimes the process for doing this isn't quite as direct as we might imagine.
Right, right. I have an almost 4-year-old and a 10-month-old. And that's exactly right. When you think about designing habits for your kids, it's really, really hard. Excuse me. Because you wanted to basically just tell them, look, if you eat your vegetables, you're going to grow up strong, big and strong. And you keep on talking about being a superhero, so why don't you just eat your vegetables?
It's never that simple. Yeah, I'm here.
It's never that simple. It's always harder than that. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've learned is that in order to try and influence those habits and create habits for our kids, we have to be very deliberate about the cues and the rewards. And sometimes we have to give them rewards that are counterintuitive. So dessert is a great example of this. I think a lot of parents feel badly about sort of using dessert as a bribe. If you eat all of your vegetables, you can have dessert. And there's some reasons to be wary about that. You're creating patterns about expecting something sweet with every meal. But on the other hand, if you want to get your kids to start habitually eating vegetables, you need to give them some reward at the end of it. It doesn't have to be dessert. It can be praise, or it can be 5 minutes of television, or it can be a special story with you. But everything that we know about how habits form in the brain, in fact, how the brain learns, is that the brain learns when it gets positive reinforcement, when it can pair a certain behavior with a certain reward. And so if you tell kids, eat your vegetables, and expect that the vegetables should be a reward in and of itself, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to be savvy about how you design the habits for your kids.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Justin in Dallas. Hey, Justin.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently read an article by David Brooks, who's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and which he responds to Mr. Duhigg's book, and he basically says that it's not just enough to identify cues and rewards in order to change behavior and habits, but that our behavior is deeply tied to emotional connections. And so not only must we identify these cues and rewards to change our habits, but also we must be committed to some greater global purpose. And so I was just curious to know what Mr. Duhigg's response would be to that. I'm getting my response off the air.
Thanks for calling. I'm quite sure that you've read David's piece, Charles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I absolutely agree with David. I think what David is saying and is that the most powerful rewards, basically what he's saying is, look, if you want to start exercising in the morning, you can give yourself a piece of chocolate as a reward. Or if you want your kids to eat vegetables, you can give them some dessert, right? These kind of surface rewards that give immediate gratification but don't mean anything deeper. But what David is saying and what the research shows is that the deepest rewards, the most meaningful rewards, are emotional rewards. So if you really want to make something into a lifelong habit, you can't just kind of bribe yourself into it.
Hmm.
You have to start doing it because it corresponds to a mental image of yourself that has meaning in this world. And exercise is a great example of this, right? So the best studies show that to start an exercise habit, what you should do is you should give yourself a piece of chocolate after you finish a run or after workout at first. First couple of weeks, give yourself some immediate reward so that your neurology begins to learn, if I exercise, something pleasant comes out of it. But over time, in about 2 weeks, you won't need that chocolate anymore. The endorphins, the endocannabinoids that your brain releases when you exercise will be enough to perpetuate the habit. But how do you make that into a lifelong pattern? The answer is that it has to fit into some emotional sense of self.
Hmm.
It has to become part of something, a value statement of what you believe in.
So you say, I'm the kind of person who takes good care of my body, something like that.
Exactly. I'm the kind of person who takes good care of my body. I'm the kind of person who is responsible enough to go running. And if you start thinking that, if that's true, then you have to live up to it in other ways, too. I'm therefore also the kind of person who's not irresponsible with money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the kind of person who takes care of their neighbors when they need a hand. What's really interesting is that some of these studies have shown there are these habits called keystone habits. Habits that seem to have a disproportionate impact. One of them is exercise. And we know that when someone starts exercising, they start eating better. And that makes sense because exercise and health are kind of related. But when people start exercising habitually, they also tend to stop using their credit cards quite as much, which makes less sense unless you sort of see this connection, that the reward for exercise is that it changes your self-image. Exercise is a keystone habit because it changes how we think about ourselves. It ties in our emotional relationship to ourselves and to the world, and that changes all kinds of other habits, like how frequently we use our credit cards, how kind we are to our spouses and to strangers. So I would say David Brooks is exactly right. What he's saying is you can't just look for shallow rewards. To make change sustainable, you have to think about these deep emotional rewards that oftentimes are things that we call character.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have David in Dallas. Hey, David.
Hi, thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I was calling primarily to ask the doctor if there's any science or research around a finite period of time, number of days. I really see often in the health and fitness industry, many arbitrarily say, well, it only takes about 20 days to get a good habit going. Is there some research around particularly how long it takes, whether it's productive or
Just a small correction, David. Charles is a journalist and not a doctor. But Charles, I'm sure you've looked into this question.
Yeah, absolutely, and the answer is unfortunately no. There's if you want to start a chocolate habit, I'll bet you could start that one in probably 7 or 12 minutes.
Pretty
fast. On the other hand, if you want to start an exercise habit, it's going to take a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. So there is no magic number. There's no magic bullet. Every habit is different. Every person is different. But what I can tell you is this. We know because of the way that neurology works that as a neural capacity builds, it gets stronger every single time it's used. So every single time you execute a habit, that habit is becoming more and more automatic. Hmm. Now, I don't know at what point it's going to become fully automatic. It's going to feel effortless. But I do promise you that if you're trying right now, if it feels like it takes some effort, it's going to be easier next time, easier the time after that, and eventually it's going to become effortless.
So it makes sense that, you know, as the more you exercise, the more you want to exercise, it almost feels addictive in a way. Talk a little bit about the addictive habits that we have to things that we don't want to do. Like, let's say checking your email 10 times a day or, you know, the bane of many offices' existence, checking in with Facebook.
Yeah. What's interesting about checking your email, so for a long time, checking your email wasn't necessarily an addictive habit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then two things happened. The first is that Microsoft changed Outlook so that every time you got a new email, there would be a ding, right? The ding.
There's your
cue. And all of a sudden there's your cue, right? And also smartphones, particularly Research in Motion, figured out that they could use some certain minerals to cause their phones to vibrate whenever mm-hmm. you got a new email. And so now we all know exactly what happens. If you're sitting in a meeting and your phone vibrates in your pocket, you probably know it's not important.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it's probably just your fantasy football scores.
Let me jump in there. We have to take a quick break, and I know it's kind
sure.
of a cliffhanger, but Charles Duhigg is my guest. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. We will talk more about those cues for things like email in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times investigative reporter Charles Duhigg, author of the new book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Join us at 800-933-5372. Okay, so Charles, we're sitting in a meeting. We feel that vibration or hear that ding from our smartphones. And all of a sudden, although we know it is most likely to be like a Groupon ad for fencing lessons or a colon cleanse, we can't bear to sit there and leave it unanswered.
That's exactly right. That craving is driving you crazy. And let me tell you what's happening inside your brain, because it's kind of interesting. We know from experiments that once you know that a cue is associated with a specific reward, once you're exposed to the cue, your brain starts anticipating and even experiencing that reward.
Mm.
So if I see a box of donuts on the counter, my brain actually starts experiencing the pleasure that I'll get from eating a donut. But if I don't end up eating the donut, or if I don't check my BlackBerry and see the fencing lessons that I just got, then my brain all of a sudden says, oh, it's almost like I loaned you some pleasure that you're not repaying me now.
Hmm.
A new pattern begins, which is very similar to depression or craving. It begins to kind of eat at you until you're saying to yourself, I really want that donut. I might not have been hungry 10 minutes ago, but now that I've seen that box, I really want that donut. Or I really want to know who sent me an email, even though I know that it's nonsense. And that's when the habit takes over.
Okay, so there are certain times in our lives when our long-established habits are actually sort of vulnerable to change. And those are graduating from school and starting a new job, getting married, having your first child. And we may not have figured this out very much consciously, but boy, companies who want to sell us things have figured them out.
That's exactly right. These are called major life moments, when companies know that without us even realizing it, all of a sudden our shopping patterns are up for grabs. One kind of interesting study showed that when people get divorced, they're more likely to start buying a new kind of beer. Or when they move into a new house, they're more likely to start buying a new brand of coffee. They often don't even realize that, but the stores do.
And how are the stores, how do the stores know when we walk in there? You've got some fascinating research here about exactly how they track our behaviors as individuals and interact with us, therefore, at the cash register.
That's right. So what they want to know is they want to know when these major life changes are happening, because we're unlikely to announce them, right? If you're pregnant, you're unlikely to tell your local grocery store that you're pregnant. Or if you're getting a divorce, you're unlikely to tell anyone you're getting a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they look for shopping patterns that would suggest that a major life event is going on. You know, for instance, let's say you suddenly start buying a whole bunch of new pots and pans, and even though you've never bought any pillows or comforters before, all of a sudden you bought a whole new set of bedding. Well, that could be some indications that you bought a new house,
mm-hmm.
and stores are aware of that. Credit card companies look at this a lot, and for instance, say if you start charging on marriage counseling on your credit card, or if you start paying for hotel rooms in the same city where you live, credit card companies will think, oh, this might be someone who's on their way towards divorce. Or, as I wrote about in the New York Times Magazine, Target has a very sophisticated model to try and figure out when its regular customers are pregnant. And for them, what they look at is, when does a woman stop buying scented lotion and start buying unscented lotion? And then suddenly buying vitamins like magnesium and zinc. And then a couple months later starts buying an unusually large number of cotton balls and washcloths and other products.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all hints that she's pregnant. And in fact, Target system is so good that it can assign someone a pregnancy prediction percentage and estimate their due date within a two-week window.
It's as good as a lot of OBGYNs can do.
That's right.
And so what they do then, because most of us these days pay with the same debit card or credit card every time we go to the store, although we don't give them our personal information, when that card is scanned, they know, oh, you're the one who bought cotton balls a week and a half ago.
Depending on the card you use, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other ways that Target can look into our lives as well, right? Once they know your name, which they know if you use a credit card or if you sign up for an email to be sent to your house, once they know all of that, they can start buying information on you. So if I have your name and your address, I can figure out what part of town you live in. I can see if there's any cars that are registered to you. I can see if you vote regularly. I can look at bank records and see if you own your house or if you rent your house, if you've ever been foreclosed on before. There's other companies that will sell me information on what magazines you subscribe to. I can put, if you go to my website, you can download a cookie and I can see what other kinds of websites you visit. I can learn almost anything about you that I want to in order to come up with a portrait of what kind of a customer you are. And my goal is to figure out your individual habits. Because I know some people react better to getting a coupon in the mail, and other people react better to getting a coupon online, and some people need a phone call to cue their habit to come into the store. If I can figure out which one you are, I can entice you to shop in my store that much easier.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have John on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My background, my undergraduate degree was actually in neuroscience, so mechanistically I understand what's going on, but now I'm a medical student in Dallas at UT Southwestern, and I tried so hard to become a morning person, but it's been nearly impossible, and I was wondering if the author had any ideas on how a person who knows too much already could change his habits into a more positive form.
What do you think, Charles?
To become a morning person?
A morning person.
Well, I think if you want to become a morning person, I think there's two things. Number one, you got to give yourself some rewards in the morning, right? If waking up in the morning is a chore and there's nothing to make it feel any better, then it's never going to become a habit. But the second thing is, you know, habits aren't magic. You sort of have to approach them a little bit rationally. And if you want to become a morning person, you probably have to go to bed a little bit earlier at night. Unfortunately, there's no habit that can offset the the rule that you need your sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, you know, focus on the cues and rewards. When you wake up in the morning, establish some cue for getting out of bed right away, right? Like the first thing that you do is you get out of bed and you go do X. And make sure that there's a reward there, that you're rewarding yourself for this behavior. That's how your neurology learns to make it more permanent.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Kristen on the line next in Dallas. Hey, Kristen.
Hi. I was wondering if in all of your research, if you have figured out why it is so much easier to establish a bad habit, or it seems to be so much easier to establish a bad habit, say that chocolate habit you mentioned earlier, versus starting what should be a good habit, which should come with rewards, you know, in and of itself. And I will take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
It's a great question. So one of the things that bad habits tend to have in common is that they deliver us very rewarding rewards right away.
Mm-hmm.
So chocolate's a great example of this, right? I mean, the nice thing about eating a piece of chocolate is it tastes good immediately. You don't have to think too hard about it.
You don't have to sweat for 45 minutes to eat it.
Exactly. And you mentioned, you know, good habits, they should have inherent rewards. And that's true. But the thing about rewards is inherent rewards, even if they're obvious to us intellectually, they might not be obvious to us emotionally, or they might not be obvious to our neurology. So exercise is a great example. We know from studies that after about a week or two of exercising, your brain will anticipate that good feeling that you have after you exercise. Those are caused by endorphins and endocannabinoids, neurochemicals that are inside your brain. Your brain will learn to anticipate those at the end of a workout. That's when working out gets easy. It becomes habitual. But for those first 2 weeks, even if you know that's going to happen, your brain doesn't. Your brain doesn't believe you. That's why if you give yourself a piece of chocolate at the end of your workout routine for the first couple of weeks, it's almost like tricking your brain into believing that there is a reward associated with exercise. And so what I would say is if you want to create more good habits, you have to take a lesson from your bad habits. Your bad habits succeed so well because they deliver a reward right away that's genuinely rewarding. If you go and you exercise and your reward is that you get to eat a whole bunch of spinach, that's not really a reward, right?
Unless you really love spinach. Yeah.
Unless you better love spinach quite a bit.
So we've talked a little.
Oh, go ahead. That's rewarding. Yeah. Oh no.
Well, we talked about the military earlier, but I'm curious about you have some really interesting stuff in here about other kinds of private organizations and corporations who use habit as part of their corporate culture.
Absolutely. In fact, I think if you look at most successful large organizations, they focus on corporate habits as a way of conducting themselves. One of my favorite stories is the story of Paul O'Neill, who, before he became Treasury Secretary, was the CEO of Alcoa, the largest aluminum company in the world at the time. Now, when Paul O'Neill took over Alcoa, everyone expected him to say he was going to focus on profits and efficiency and making employees work harder. But in his first meeting, what he said was, his number one goal was workplace safety habits. He wanted to improve Alcoa's safety habits so that no one ever was injured. And that's a pretty audacious goal in a company where people are handling molten metal all the time.
Yeah.
Alcoa's factories were dangerous places. But what Paul O'Neill knew was that worker safety was a keystone habit. That once he started making changes around that habit, it would unlock all these other patterns within the corporation. It would make other organizational habits more flexible. And he was exactly right. Within 2 years of Paul O'Neill taking over Alcoa, it not only had become one of the safest companies in the world, it was the top performer in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And when I talk to company after company, be it General Electric or Starbucks, who focuses on teaching employees willpower habits, what CEOs talk to me about is creating the right organizational habits because they know they can only order their employees to do so much. But if you teach them the right habits, then great customer service or great work becomes the automatic response.
So a lot of people listening may have actually experienced some of those Starbucks willpower habits at work. Explain what those are.
So Starbucks had this basic problem, which is that a lot of the employees they would hire were recent high school graduates. And at one point, Starbucks was hiring 1,700 new people a day. But the thing that Starbucks knew it had to do was that it has to deliver great customer service. No one's willing to pay $4 for a latte unless it's delivered with a smile from someone who's friendly. Some of these recent high school graduates, though, they were basically kids, right? They would work 8 hours, and at the end of an 8-hour shift, you're tired, and if a customer comes up and yells at you, you yell back at them, or you get drawn into workplace drama. So what Starbucks and Howard Schultz did is they created a new training system to teach their employees willpower habits so that even at the end of an 8-hour shift, it would be easy for employees to smile and be polite. One of my favorite examples of this is something called the latte method, and it's modeled right on the habit loop. There's a habit that they teach employees. If a customer comes up and yells at you, that's the cue, is a screaming customer, then the routine is latte, and latte stands for listen, acknowledge, thank, take action, explain. Right? It's a simple routine you go to. Just listen to their complaint, repeat it back to them, acknowledge them, thank them, give them a new cup of coffee by taking action, explain why it happened and that it won't happen again. And the reward there is that the customer who was just screaming at you a second ago suddenly is happy because you just gave them a brand new cup of coffee. You solved their problem for them. What Starbucks discovered was that by teaching employees these habits that essentially strengthened their willpower during these moments when otherwise they might just yell back or they might break down, that they could essentially make customer service a habitual response. And it's worked.
So are you now free of all bad habits that have plagued you throughout your entire life?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, I think there's two ways of answering that. The first is that there's some bad habits that are bad habits that I don't actually mind that much.
Right. They might bother other people, but not you.
They might bother other people, and they might bother me a little bit, but not as much as getting rid of them would be, right? And part of life, I think, and understanding habits is to really figure out which habits really bother me and which don't. Which am I genuinely okay with? Because I don't want to lose that reward. But then the other part of that is the habits that I have changed, and we know from scientific studies any habit can be changed, no matter how old you are, no matter how ingrained it is. And since I started writing this book, I've lost like 30 pounds. I'm now training for the New York City Marathon. I mean, it has really, I have to say, it actually has made my life much, much better. And part of the reason it's better, not only because I sort of control these habits more now, but also just because I'm so much more aware of them.
Charles Duhigg is an investigative reporter for the New York Times and author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Charles, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got questions, comments, suggestions, you can send those out to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.